Welcome to Reading Together, a Near FM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound Division Fund. The Near FM crew travelled to public locations around the city where different readers from local communities read the 15 stories that constitute James Joyce's book, The Dubliners. Dubliners was designated by Dublin, One City, One Book, as 2011 Book of the Year. Near FM wanted to join in the celebration, organising a series of public readings where Joyce's Dubliners would be read in public places to reach a wider audience. Today we'll be listening to A Little Cloud and After the Race, read by some of the Sweeney's Pharmacy Reading Group. But first, Wendy Conroy, one of the volunteers that works to ensure Sweeney's remains open as a landmark of Joyce's writing and of Dublin's culture. She will tell us about the interesting history of the pharmacy and their current activities.
My name is Wendy Conroy and I'm one of the volunteers at Sweeney's on Lincoln Place in Dublin. Sweeney's is a pharmacy that was made famous by James Joyce in his book Ulysses. Now it's more than that. There's sort of two sides to Sweeney's. One is to promote the work of James Joyce and to make it accessible to people who previously wouldn't have gone near it, who would have thought, that's far too difficult for me. So every day at 1 o'clock we read from his short stories, Dubliners, or from Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which are two of his more accessible works. So you get a short story which would be funny or very sad, but would move you in some way, hopefully, to go on and read a little bit more of his work. I got involved because I was unemployed. All of us were actually unemployed. And sitting at home with nothing to do, and a friend said, would you like to have a look at this? It's a project that's being set up. And it was love at first sight. My love would be books. I had a bookshop in Northern Ireland for many years. So I brought the books to Sweeney's. We have another guy who was a shoe salesman for over 40 years, actually. And he could sell anything to anybody. He's a wonderful personality. He speaks over 6 languages fluently and can make people feel very welcome. And now has learned quite a lot about Joyce actually as well. So it happened because a reading group came here. They asked, could they use the space? And while they were here reading, I was listening and I thought, there really are people who love this work. And if you get a few of them, they will infect other people, if you like. So that's how it started. So the initial reading group was on a Monday morning. It was Ulysses. And I would say that 4 people out of the possibly 10 who came had read Ulysses, knew all about it, laughed at all the appropriate bits, and the rest of us sat there absolutely dumbfounded. And at the end of it, we would say, did you understand that? And everyone would go, not one word. And the thing about Ulysses is when you first read it, you think, oh, good Lord, this is very, very difficult. So what we try to do is encourage you, if you read it aloud, which is what Joyce wanted, he said it is an oral work. So if you read it aloud, even just as a couple, you'll hear the humour. You'll hear what it is that he's trying to get across. But if you read it and keep it in your head, it just doesn't work. The man himself was a genius who wrote a great piece of work. But people have come in here, and we have great arguments about it. Ulysses is the greatest piece of literature, greatest novel ever written. Well, do you know what? No, it's not. If you're 9 years of age and you're reading Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, that's the best bit of literature that was ever written. It's very personal. It's very to the moment, to the time of your life. We'll often say to people when they say, oh, I've read Ulysses, and they're 19, and we just laugh. You could not possibly understand Ulysses if you were 19, except at an academic level. In other words, someone else's interpretation of it, because you haven't lived. So our groups tend to attract people who are retired, and I hope they don't take offence at my saying that, who have the time and can get the notes, can get the guides that go along with them, and study it and say, okay, that's what he's talking about. Finnegan's Wake is a step too far. No, we have 2 reading groups for Finnegan's Wake. We have one that's taught, and that's on a Monday at 1 o'clock, and they absolutely love it. Their Christmas party is to recreate part of the walk out to Chapel Izzard. It's not for the faint-hearted. I don't get it. I sat in on the first reading, and at the end of it, I said, "Who died?" And they said, "Wendy, the clue's in the title." And I still didn't understand what was going on. But they love it. And then we have an informal group on a Sunday, and they just read it. Read it, read it, read it. Like a poem, like a piece of verse. It's two levels. So the first group will take 10 years to read it, and the other group have read it many times. There's a language all of its own, which is why it's too difficult. Swenny's is self-funding. The people who come here are asked for a donation. We have books and beautiful hats and pieces of antiques that we sell on consignment. So we take a percentage of the sale. And that way we stay afloat. We have a wonderful landlord who works with us, but the overheads are very high. It's €100 a day to open the door of Swenny's. So it's very difficult. So at the moment we're in the course of looking for funding. But we've been running like this for 3 years. So, you know, it's through recession. UNESCO, when Dublin became a UNESCO City of Literature, we became part of that group. And we get a little funding from them when they can. And the Dubliners One City One Book was a huge kick for Joyce, if you like. So people who wanted to hear it, yes, we did. We got a lot of good feedback, and people seemed to enjoy it. The numbers on the groups picked up, but because we're looking for donations, we didn't always get it right. We're not business people, I suppose, really. I personally do it for the love of Swenny's. The guys do it, I would say, for the love of the literature. Yeah. And also for the love of meeting people. If you're unemployed or it's some for early retirement or just retirement, this gives you a purpose. This gives you... It's quite something to get up on a Monday morning and get into town for Finnegan's Wake. I mean, that's pretty incredible, really. The building itself was purpose-built. It was in the mid-1800s. Business premises on the ground floor and apartments, what they were called in those days, tenements above. So families lived above the shop. And the first pharmacist here was Mark Swenny. And he was a doctor. But his son, Mark Jr., didn't do medicine. He did pharmacy. So he built all of the counters, the mahogany counters, the work surfaces that you see now. So it would have been an apothecary. You would have had your condition diagnosed and the medicine would have been made here for you. Then it was passed to... down through the Swenny family until they left in early 1900s. So Joyce would have met Frederick William Swenny. He would have been here at the time that Joyce was studying in UCD, which would have been in Earlsford Terrace. Mm-hmm. And he would have been kicking around this parish waiting for his pals to come out of Trinity. So he knew the place very well. But also Oscar Wilde, who was born and lived on this corner, he would have been here. Beckett, Yeats, Le Fanu, other writers who were in this area would have come to Swenny's because that's the only place that was here. So it's got a wonderful literary history. And the prescriptions are in the drawers exactly as it was when finally it was Carmel and Martina Quinn who were the final custodians. And when they retired, everything was left intact. One of the pharmacists who was here was a lady who was the first woman in Ireland to fly, to go up in an aeroplane. And she's quite famous, in the parish. I've had the police from the local police station in to tell us that if they had a substance that they didn't know what it was, they brought it to Angela. And so that was CSI Angela Quinn, which we always think is quite funny. Because of its location... I mean, if you even just take immediate history, last year, this whole area was sealed off. There were no people here for the visit of Queen Elizabeth and of President Obama. But we were here. I stood here. I saw him. I saw the Queen. all the people who must have passed by this door. It's quite a sight, quite a place.
Thanks, Wendy. And next is After the Race.
The cars came scudding in towards Dublin, running evenly like pellets in the groove of the Naas Road. At the crest of the hill at Inchicore, sightseers had gathered in clumps to watch the cars careering homeward. And through this channel of poverty and inaction, the continent sped its wealth and industry. Now and again, the clumps of people raised the cheer of the gratefully oppressed. Their sympathy, however, was for the blue cars, the cars of their friends, the French. The French, moreover, were virtual victors. Their team had finished solidly. They had been placed second and third, and the driver of the winning German car was reported a Belgian. Each blue car, therefore, received a double measure of welcome as it topped the crest of the hill, and each cheer of welcome was acknowledged with smiles and nods by those in the car. In one of these trimly built cars was a party of four young men whose spirits seemed to be at present well above the level of successful Gallicism. In fact, these four young men were almost hilarious. They were Charles Segon, the owner of the car, André Riviere, a young electrician of Canadian birth, a huge Hungarian named Villona, and a neatly groomed young man named Doyle. Segon was in good humour because he had unexpectedly received some orders in advance. He was about to start a motor establishment in Paris. And Riviere was in good humour because he was to be appointed manager of the establishment. These two young men, who were cousins, were also in good humour because of the success of the French cars. Villona was in good humour because he had had a very satisfactory luncheon. And, besides, he was an optimist by nature. The fourth member of the party, however, was too excited to be genuinely happy. He was about 26 years of age, with a soft, light brown moustache and rather innocent-looking grey eyes. His father, who had begun life as an advanced nationalist, had modified his views early. He had made his money as a butcher in Kingstown, and by opening shops in Dublin and in the suburbs, he had made his money many times over. He had also been fortunate enough to secure some of the police contracts, and in the end, he had become rich enough to be alluded to in the Dublin newspapers as a merchant prince. He had sent his son to England to be educated in a big Catholic college and had afterwards sent him to Dublin University to study law. Jimmy did not study very earnestly and took to bad courses for a while. He had money and he was popular. And he divided his time curiously between musical and motoring circles. Then he had been sent for a term to Cambridge to see a little life. His father, remonstrative but covertly proud of the excess, had paid his bills and brought him home. It was at Cambridge that he had met Segon. They were not much more than acquaintances as yet, but Jimmy found great pleasure in the society of one who had seen so much of the world and was reputed to own some of the biggest hotels in France. Such a person, as his father agreed, was well worth knowing, even if he had not been the charming companion he was. Villona was entertaining also, a brilliant pianist, but unfortunately very poor. The car ran on merrily with its cargo of hilarious youths. The two cousins sat on the front seat. Jimmy and his Hungarian friend sat behind. Decidedly, Villona was in excellent spirits. He kept up a deep bass hum of melody for miles of the road. The Frenchmen flung their laughter and light words over their shoulders, and often Jimmy had to strain forward to catch the quick phrase. This was not altogether pleasant for him, as he had nearly always to make a deft guess at the meaning and shout back a suitable answer in the face of a high wind. Besides, Villona's humming could confuse anybody, the noise of the car, too. Rapid motion through space elates one. So does notoriety. So does the possession of money. These were three good reasons for Jimmy's excitement. He had been seen by many of his friends that day in the company of these Continentals. At the control, Seguin had presented him to one of the French competitors, and, in answer to his confused murmur of compliment, the swarthy face of the driver had disclosed a line of shiny white teeth. It was pleasant, after that honour, to return to the profane world of spectators and mid nudges and significant looks. Then, as to money, he really had a great sum under his control. Seguin, perhaps, would not think it a great sum, but Jimmy, who, in spite of temporary errors, was at heart the inheritor of solid instincts, knew well with what difficulty it had been got together. This knowledge had previously kept his bills within the limit of reasonable recklessness, and if he had been so conscious of the labour latent in money when there had been question merely of some freak of the higher intelligence, how much more so now, when he was about to stake the greater part of his substance? It was a serious thing for him.
Of course, the investment was a good one, and Seguin had managed to give the impression that it was by a favour of friendship the mite of Irish money was to be included in the capital of the concern. Jimmy had a respect for his father's shrewdness in business matters, and in this case it had been his father who had first suggested the investment. Money to be made in the motor business. Pots of money. Moreover, Seguin had the unmistakable air of wealth. Jimmy set out to translate into day's work that lordly car in which he sat. How smoothly it ran! In what style they had come careering along the country roads! The journey laid a magical finger on the genuine pulse of life, and gallantly the machinery of human nerves strove to answer the bounding courses of the swift blue animal. They drove down Dame Street. The street was busy with unusual traffic, loud with the horns of motorists and the gongs of impatient tram drivers. Near the bank, Seguin drew up and Jimmy and his friend alighted. A little knot of people collected on the footpath to pay homage to the snorting motor. The party was to dine together that evening in Seguin's hotel, and meanwhile Jimmy and his friend, who was staying with him, were to go home to dress. The car steered out slowly for Grafton Street while the two young men pushed their way through the knot of gazers. They walked northward, with a curious feeling of disappointment in the exercise, while the city hung its pale globes of light above them in a haze of summer evening. In Jimmy's house, this dinner had been pronounced an occasion. A certain pride mingled with his parents' trepidation, a certain eagerness also, to play fast and loose, for the names of great foreign cities have at least this virtue. Jimmy, too, looked very well when he was dressed, and as he stood in the hall giving a last equation to the bows of his dress tie, his father may have felt even commercially satisfied at having secured for his son qualities often unpurchable. His father, therefore, was unusually friendly with Villona, and his manner expressed a real respect for foreign accomplishments. But the subtlety of his host was probably lost upon the Hungarian, who was beginning to have a sharp desire for his dinner. The dinner was excellent, exquisite. Seguin, Jimmy decided, had a very refined taste. The party was increased by a young Englishman named Routh, whom Jimmy had seen with Seguin at Cambridge. The young men supped in a snug room lit by electric candle lamps. They talked volubly and with little reserve. Jimmy, whose imagination was kindling, conceived the lively youth of the Frenchmen, twined elegantly upon the firm framework of the Englishman's manner. A graceful image of his, he thought, and just one. He admired the dexterity with which their host directed the conversation. The five young men had various tastes, and their tongues had been loosened. Villona, with immense respect, began to discover, to the mildly surprised Englishman, the beauties of the English madrigal, deploring the loss of old instruments. Riviere, not wholly ingeniously, undertook to explain to Jimmy the triumph of the French mechanicians. the resonant voice of the Hungarian was about to prevail in ridicule of the spurious lutes of the Romantic painters when Sugrán shepherded his party into politics. Here was congenial ground for all. Jimmy, under generous influences, felt the buried zeal of his father wake to life within him. He aroused the torpid Routh at last. The room grew doubly hot, and Seguin's task grew harder each moment. There was even danger of personal spite. The alert host, at an opportunity, lifted his glass to humanity, and when the toast had been drunk, he threw open a window significantly.
That night the city wore the mask of a capital. The five young men strolled along Stephen's Green in a faint cloud of aromatic smoke. They talked loudly and gaily, and their cloaks dangled from their shoulders. The people made way for them. At the corner of Grafton Street, a short, fat man was putting two handsome ladies on a car in charge of another fat man. The car drove off, and the short, fat man caught sight of the party. "André, it's Farley." A torrent of talk followed. Farley was an American. No one knew very well what the talk was about. Valona and Riviere were the noisiest, but all the men were excited. They got up in a car, squeezing themselves together amid much laughter. They drove by the crowd, blended now into soft colours, to a music of merry bells. They took the train at Westland Row, and in a few seconds, as it seemed to Jimmy, they were walking out of Kingstown Station. The ticket collector saluted Jimmy. He was an old man. "Fine night, sir." It was a serene summer night. The harbour lay like a darkened mirror at their feet. They proceeded towards it with linked arms, singing Cadet Roussel in chorus, stamping their feet at every ho, 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 hey, vraiment. They got into a rowboat at the slip and made out for the American's yacht. There was to be supper, music, cards. Valona said with conviction, "It is delightful." There was a yacht piano in the cabin. Valona played a waltz for Farley and Riviere, Farley acting as cavalier and Riviere as lady. Then an impromptu square dance, the men devising original figures. What merriment! Jimmy took his part with a will. This was seeing life, at least. Then Farley got out of breath and cried, "Stop!" A man brought in a light supper, and the young men sat down to it, for form's sake. They drank. However, it was the Bohemian. They drank Ireland, England, France, Hungary, the United States of America. Jimmy made a speech, a long speech. Valona saying, "Hear, hear," whenever there was a pause. There was a great clapping of hands when he sat down. It must have been a good speech. Farley clapped him on the back and laughed loudly. What jovial fellows. What good company they were. Cards, cards, the table was cleared. Valona returned quietly to his piano and played voluntaries for them. The other men played game after game, flinging themselves boldly into the adventure. They drank the health of the Queen of Hearts and of the Queen of Diamonds. Jimmy felt obscurely the lack of an audience. The wit was flashing. Play ran very high and paper began to pass. Jimmy did not know exactly who was winning, but he knew that he was losing. But it was his own fault, for he frequently mistook his cards, and the other men had to calculate his IOUs for him. They were devils of fellows. But he wished they would stop. It was getting late. Someone gave the toast of the yacht, the Belle of Newport, and then someone proposed one great game for a finish. The piano had stopped. Valona must have gone up on deck. It was a terrible game. They stopped just before the end of it to drink for luck. Jimmy understood that the game lay between Routh and Segun. What excitement! Jimmy was excited too. He would lose, of course. How much had he written away? The men rose to their feet to pay the last tricks, talking and gesticulating. Routh won. The cabin shook with the young men's cheering and the cards were bundled together. They began then to gather in what they had won. Farley and Jimmy were the heaviest losers. He knew that he would regret in the morning, but at present he was glad of the rest, glad of the dark stupor that would cover up his folly. He leaned his elbows on the table and rested his head between his hands, counting the beats of his temples. The cabin door opened and he saw the Hungarian standing in a shaft of grey light. "Daybreak, gentlemen."
I'm Val O'Donnell. I'm one of the regular readers here at Swenny's, where we read Dubliners at Lunchtimes, most days Finnegan is Awake on Monday, also Ulysses on Thursday evenings and Saturday mornings, which are very popular. Well, I was always interested in, had read Ulysses and wanted to make more sense of it and to hear it read, and that's one of the benefits we find here, that people reading it aloud get an awful lot more from it, understanding from it, as well as the enjoyment of actually reading it. Really, it aids the understanding of the work. But they're very colourful characters, that makes them easier to read, I suppose, is the reason, and reminds us of the way things were in a certain era many years ago when there was a male-dominated society, and I think that comes through in the story, as well as the great frustration on the part of poor Tommy Chandler. Well, we certainly learn a lot about the past, and he was very, very fond of his own recollections of, it's almost as if Dublin had crystallised for him in 1904, and he remembers so many of the details and put them into his work. So you see these complemented often with pictures of the time. It is very evocative altogether. But in terms of relevance today, I think it's more the literary relevance is so important because of the innovations that he made in writing Ulysses, in particular, and Finnegan's Awake later. These are generally regarded as groundbreaking novels of the modernist period, and that many writers followed that example afterwards and become one of the great monuments of 20th century literature. Well, I think a person is a Dubliner if they're born in Dublin, obviously, stay in Dublin, imbue its particular culture and its wit. And it applies to some other people who came to Dublin. I'm just thinking of Flann O'Brien, Miles Le Gaupeline, who called himself a Dubliner himself, although he was born in Strabane, but was very proud of absorbing the Dublin culture and writing in a Dublin type of patois. No, well, to be honest, I do read a lot of Flann O'Brien. I have a few shows, really, on the life of Flann O'Brien and his work. But I also, actually last week, adapted one of the Dubliner stories, A Mother, which was presented at the James Joyce Centre last Thursday and Friday, and a new adaptation of a very popular story, A Mother, from Dubliners.
My name is Paddy O'Dwyer, and one of the reading group here in Swenny's. Well, I'm a friend of that gentleman there, Val, and I just met him by chance, and he told me about the group, and I said, okay, I'll come along. So that was nearly a year ago now, so I'm still here. In particular, James Joyce, because I was familiar with some of the chapters, and I had made several attempts to read the book through. And when I came to the group first and found you were reading it in a group, I said, okay, I'll get all the way through it by reading with this group. So I've read it, I'm almost finished my second time around the book. So it's really nice to know it and understand it. And it's such fun to read out loud. And also the number of visitors that come in is terrific. So it's lovely to hear read in all sorts of accents. Different Irish accents, different English accents, European, Japanese, Korean, whatever, American, of course. And I really enjoy that every week. Yeah. I like the stories, particularly where he has dialogue in the stories. He's very good at writing dialogue. So stories like A Mother, like Ivy Day in the Committee Room, The Dead, all those have lots of dialogue, and I enjoy those in particular. But I enjoy other stories as well. I like particularly his young stories about young children and adolescents. I enjoy them very much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure, anyone can be a Dubliner now, but I think Dublin has always been an open cosmopolitan city, so I like the mix of people in Dublin. So for me, it's somebody that loves Dublin
but yet is welcoming to strangers or people who want to make Dublin their home. Yes, of course, yes. So Dublin, I still love Dublin, but we lost a lot of things in the past, buildings, and we didn't care so much, but I think and I hope that's changed, yeah.
You are listening to Reading Together, an ERFM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound and Vision Fund. Before the break, we listened to one of Joyce's short stories, After the Race, published as part of Dubliners, and read by Sweeney's Pharmacy Reading Group, and the opinions of the Sweeney's Reading Group. Next, we are going to hear them again, reading A Little Cloud.
8 years before, he had seen his friend off at the North Wall and wished him Godspeed. Gallagher had got on. You could tell that at once by his travelled air, his well-cut tweed suit and fearless accent. Few fellas had talents like his, and fewer still could remain unspoiled by great success. Gallagher's heart was in the right place, and he had deserved to win. It was something to have a friend like that. Little Chandler's thoughts, ever since lunchtime, had been of his meeting with Gallagher, Gallagher's invitation, and of the great city London where Gallagher lived. He was called Little Chandler because, though he was but slightly under the average structure, he gave one of the idea of being a little man. His hands were white and small, his frame was fragile, his voice was quiet, and his manners were refined. He took the greatest care of his fair silken hair and moustache, and used perfume discreetly on his handkerchief. The half moons of his nails were perfect, and when he smiled you caught a glimpse of a row of childish white teeth. As he sat at his desk in the King's Inn, he thought what changes those 8 years had brought. The friend whom he had known under a shabby and necessitous guise had become a brilliant figure on the London press. He turned often from his tiresome writings to gaze out of the office window. The glow of a late autumn sunset covered the grass plots and walks. It cast a shower of kindly golden dust on the untidy nurses and decrepit old men who drowsed on the benches. It flickered upon all the moving figures, on the children who ran screaming along the gravel paths, and on everyone who passed through the gardens. He watched the scene and thought of life, and, as always happened when he thought of life, he became sad. A gentle melancholy took possession of him. He felt how useless it was to struggle against fortune, this being the burden of wisdom which the ages had bequeathed to him. He remembered the books of poetry upon his shelves at home. He had bought them in his bachelor days, and many an evening, as he sat in the little room off the hall, he had just tempted to take one down from the bookshelf and read out something to his wife. But shyness had always held him back, and so the books had remained on the shelves. At times he repeated lines to himself and disconsoled him. When his hour had struck, he stood up and took leave of his desk and of his fellow clerks punctiliously. He emerged from under the feudal arch of the King's Inn, a neat and modest figure, and walked swiftly down Henrietta Street. The golden sunset was waning and the air had grown sharp. A horde of grimy children populated the street. They stood or ran in the roadway or crawled up the steps before the gaping doors or squatted like mice upon the thresholds. Little Chandler gave them no thought. He picked his way deftly through all that minute vermin-like life and under the shadow of the gaunt, spectral mansions in which the old nobility of Dublin had roistered. No memory of the past touched him, for his mind was full of a present joy. He had never been in Carlisle's, but he knew the value of the name. He knew that people went there after the theatre to eat oysters and drink liqueurs, and he had heard that the waiters there spoke French and German. Walking swiftly, but at night he had seen cabs drawn up before the door and richly dressed ladies escorted by cavaliers alight and enter quickly. They wore noisy dresses and many wraps. Their faces were powdered and they caught up their dresses when they touched earth like Atlantis. He had always passed without turning his head to look. It was his habit to walk swiftly in the street, even by day, and whenever he found himself in the city late at night, he hurried on his way apprehensively and excitedly. Sometimes, however, he courted the cause of his fear. He chose the darkest and narrowest streets, and as he walked boldly forward, the silence that was spread about his footsteps troubled him. The wandering silent figures troubled him, and at times a sound of low fugitive laughter made him tremble like a leaf. He turned to the right towards Capel Street. Ignatius Gallagher on the London press. Who would have thought it possible 8 years before? Still, now that he reviewed the past, little Chandler could remember many signs of future generations in his friends. People used to say that Ignatius Gallagher was wild. Of course, he didn't mix with a rakish set of fellows at the time, drank freely and borrowed money on all sides. In the end, he had got mixed up in some shabby affair, some money transaction. At least there was one version of his flight, but nobody denied him talent. There was always a certain something in Ignatius Gallagher that impressed you in spite of yourself. Even when he was out at elbows and at his wit's end for money, he kept up a bold face. Little Chandler remembered, and the remembrance brought a slight flush of pride to his cheek. One of Ignatius Gallagher's sayings when he was in a tight corner. "Half time now, boys," he used to say lightheartedly. "Where's my considering cap?" That was Ignatius Gallagher all out, and damn it, you couldn't but admire him for it. Little Chandler quickened his pace. For the first time in his life, he felt himself superior to the people he passed. For the first time, his soul revolted against the dull inelegance of Capel Street. There was no doubt about it. If you wanted to succeed, you had to go away. He could do nothing in Dublin. As he crossed Grattan Bridge, he looked down the river towards the lower quays and pitied the poor, stunted houses. They seemed to him a band of tramps huddled together along the river banks, their old coats covered with dust and soot, stupefied by the panorama of sunset and waiting for the first chill of night to bid them arise, shake themselves and be gone. He wondered whether he could write a poem to express his idea. Perhaps Gallagher might be able to get it into some London paper for him. Could he write something original? He was not sure what idea he wished to express, but the thought that a poetic moment had touched him took life within him like an infant hope. He stepped onwards bravely. Every step brought him nearer to London, further from his own solar inartistic life. A light began to tremble on the horizon of his mind. He was not so old, 32. His temperament might be said to be just at the point of maturity. There were so many different moods and impressions that he wished to express in verse. He felt them within him. He tried to weigh his soul to see if it was a poet's soul. Melancholy was the dominant note of his temperament, he thought. But it was a melancholy tempered by occurrences of faith and resignation and simple joy. If he could give expression to it in a book of poems, perhaps men would listen. He would never be popular, he saw that. He could not sway the crowd, but he might appeal to a little circle of kindred minds. The English critics perhaps would recognise him as one of the Celtic school, by reason of the melancholy tone of his poems. Besides that, he would put in allusions. He began to invent sentences and phrases from the notice which his book would get. Mr. Chandler has the gift of easy and graceful verse. A wistful sadness pervades these poems. The Celtic note. It was a pity his name was not more Irish-looking. Perhaps it would be better to insert his mother's name before the surname. Thomas Malone Chandler, or better still, T. Malone Chandler. He would speak to Gallagher about it. He pursued his reverie so ardently that he passed his street and had to turn back. As he came near Carlos's, his former agitation began to overmaster him and he halted the door before in indecision. Finally, he opened the door and entered.
The light and noise of the bar held him at the doorways for a few moments. He looked about him, but his sight was confused by the shining of many red and green wine glasses. The bar seemed to be full of people, and he felt that the people were observing him curiously. He glanced quickly to right and left, frowning slightly, to make his errand appear serious. But when his sight cleared a little, he saw that nobody had turned to look at him. And there, sure enough, was Ignatius Gallagher, leaning with his back against the counter and his feet planted far apart.
"Hello, Tommy, old hero. Here you are. What is it to be? What will you have? I'm taking whiskey. Better stuff than we get across the water. Soda? Lithia? No mineral? I'm the same. Spoils the flavour. Here, garçon, bring us two halves of malt whiskey, like a good fellow. Well, and how have you been pulling along since I saw you last? Dear God, how old we're getting. Did you see any signs of ageing in me? A little grey and thin on the top, what?"
Ignatius Gallagher took off his hat and displayed a large, closely cropped head. His face was heavy, pale and clean-shaven. His eyes, which were of bluish slate colour, relieved his unhealthy pallor and shone out plainly above the vivid orange tie he wore. Between these rival features, The lips appeared very long and shapeless and colourless. He bent his head and felt with two sympathetic fingers the thin hair at the crown. Little Chandler shook his head as a denial. Ignatius Gallagher put on his hat again.
It pulls you down, press life. Always hurry and scurry, looking for a copy and sometimes not finding it. And then always to have something new in your stuff. Damn proofs and printers, I say, for a few days. I'm deuced glad, I can tell you, to get back to the old country. It does a fellow good. A bit of a holiday. I feel a ton better since I landed again in dear, dirty Dublin. Here you are, Tommy. Water, say when. You don't know how what's good for you, my boy. I drink mine neat.
I drink very little, as a rule. An odd half one or so when I meet an old friend from the crowd, that's all.
Ah, well. Here's to us and to old times and old acquaintance. I met some of the old gang today. O'Hara seems to be in a bad way. What's he doing?
Nothing. He's gone to the dogs.
But Hogan is a good sit, hasn't he?
Yes, he's in the Land Commission.
Oh, I met him one night in London and he seemed to be very flush. Poor O'Hara. Booze, I suppose.
Other things too.
Tommy, I see you haven't changed an atom. You're the same serious, very serious person that used to lecture me on Sunday mornings when I had a sore head and a fur on my tongue. You'd want to knock about a bit in the world. Have you never been anywhere, even for a day trip?
I've been to the Isle of Man.
The Isle of Man. Now, go to London or Paris. Paris for choice. That'll do you good.
Have you seen Paris?
Oh, I should think I have. I've knocked about there a little.
And is it really so beautiful, as they say?
Beautiful? Not so beautiful, you know. Of course, it is beautiful, but it's the life of Paris. That's the thing. Ah, there's no city like Paris for gaiety, movement, excitement. I've been to the Moulin Rouge, and I've been to all the bohemian cafes. Hot stuff. not for a pious chap like you, Tommy.
Little Chandler said nothing until the barman returned with two glasses. Then he touched his friend's glass lightly and reciprocated the former toast. He was beginning to feel somewhat disillusioned. Gallagher's accent and way of expressing himself did not please him. There was something vulgar in his friend, which he had not observed before. But perhaps it was only the result of living in London amid the bustle and competition of the press. The old personal charm was still there under this new gaudy manner. And after all, Gallagher had lived, he had seen the world. Little Chandler looked at his friend enviously.
Everything in Paris is gay. They believe in enjoying life. And don't you think they're right? If you want to enjoy yourself properly, you must go to Paris. And mind you, they have a great feeling for the Irish there. When they heard I was from Ireland, they were ready to eat me, man.
Tell me, is it true that Paris is so immoral, as they say?
Every place is immoral. Of course, you do find spicy bits in Paris. Go to one of the students' balls, for instance. They're lively, if you like, when the coquettes begin to let themselves loose. You know what they are, I suppose.
I've heard of them.
You must say what you like, may say what you like, but there's no woman like a Parisienne for style, for go.
Then it is an immoral city. I mean, compared with London or Dublin.
London? It's six of one and a half dozen of the other. You ask Hogan, my boy. I showed him a bit about London when he was over there. He'd open your eye. I say, Tommy, don't make punch of that whiskey. Liquor up.
No, really.
Oh, come on, another one won't do you any harm. What is it, the same again, I suppose?
Well, all right.
Francois, same again. Would you smoke, Tommy?
Ignatius Gallagher produced his cigar case. The two friends lit their cigars and puffed at them in silence until their drinks were served.
I'll tell you my opinion. It's a rum world. Talk of immorality. I've heard of cases. Oh, what am I saying? I've known them. Cases of immorality.
Ignatius Gallagher puffed thoughtfully at his cigar, and then in a calm historian's tone, he proceeded to sketch for his friend some pictures of the corruption which was rife abroad. He summarized the vices of many capitals and seemed inclined to award the palm to Berlin. Some things he could not vouch for, his friends had told him, but of others he had had personal experience. He spared neither rank nor caste. He revealed many of the secrets of religious houses on the continent and described some of the practices which were fashionable in high society, and ended by telling with details a story about an English duchess, a story which he knew to be true. Little Chandler was astonished.
Ah, well, here we are in old jog-along Dublin, where nothing is known of such things.
How dull you must find it, after all the other places you've been.
Well, it's a relaxation to come over here, you know. And after all, it's the old country, as they say, isn't it? You can't help having a certain feeling for it. That's human nature. But tell me something about yourself. Hogan told me you had tasted the joys of connubial bliss 2 years ago, was it?
Yes, I was married last May, 12 months.
I hope it's not too late in the day to offer my best wishes, sir. I didn't know your address, or I'd have done so at the time. Well, Tommy, I wish you and yours every joy of life. Old chap, tons of money, and may you never die till I shoot you. And that's the wish of a sincere friend, an old friend. You know that.
I know that.
Any youngsters?
We have one child.
Oh, son or daughter?
A little boy.
Bravo! I wouldn't doubt you, Tommy.
Little Chandler smiled, looked confusedly at his glass, and bit his lower lip with three childishly white front teeth.
I hope you'll spend an evening with us. Before you go back, I mean, my wife will be delighted to meet you. We can have a little music and...
Thanks awfully, old chap. But I'm sorry we didn't meet earlier, but I have to leave tomorrow night.
Tonight, perhaps?
Hey, I'm awfully sorry, old man. You see, I'm over here with another fellow. Clever young chap he is, too. And we arranged to go to do a little card party. Only for that.
Oh, in that case.
But who knows? Next year, I may take a little skip over here. Now that I've broken the ice, it's only a pleasure deferred.
Very well. The next time you come, we must have an evening together. That's agreed now, isn't it?
Yes, that's agreed. Next year, if I come, parole d'honneur.
And to clinch the bargain, we'll just have one more now.
Oh, is it to be the last? Because, you know, I do have an AP.
Oh, yes, positively.
Very well, then. Let's have another one as a jochendurus. That's good vernacular for a small whisky, I believe.
Little Chandler ordered the drinks. The blush which had risen to his face a few moments before was establishing itself. A trifle made him blush at any time, and now he felt warm and excited. Three small whiskies had gone to his head, and Gallagher's strong cigar had confused his mind, for he was a delicate and abstinent person. The adventure of meeting Gallagher after 8 years, of finding himself with Gallagher in Corliss's, surrounded by lights and noise, of listening to Gallagher's stories, and of sharing for a brief space Gallagher's vagrant and triumphant life, upset the equipoise of his sensitive nature. He felt acutely the contrast between his own life and his friend's, and it seemed to him unjust. Gallagher was his inferior in birth and education. He was sure that he could do something better than his friend had ever done or could ever do. Something higher than mere tawdry journalism, if he only got the chance. What was it that stood in his way? His unfortunate timidity? He wished to vindicate himself in some way, to assert his manhood. He saw behind Gallagher's refusal of his invitation. Gallagher was only patronising him by his friendliness, just as he was patronising Ireland by his visit. The barman brought the drinks. Little Chandler pushed one glass towards his friend and took up the other boldly.
Who knows? When you come next year, I may have the pleasure of wishing long life and happiness to Mr. and Mrs. Ignatius Gallagher.
Ignatius Gallagher, in the act of drinking, closed one eye expressively over the rim of his glass. When he had drunk, he smacked his lips decisively, set down his glass and said,
"No blooming fear of that, my boy. I'm going to have my fling first and see a bit of life and the world before I put my head in the sack, if I ever do."
Someday you will.
You think so?
You'll put your head in the sack, like everyone else, if you can find the girl.
He had slightly emphasised his tone, and he was aware that he had betrayed himself. But though the colour had heightened in his cheek, he did not flinch from his friend's gaze. Ignatius Gallagher watched him for a few moments and then said,
If ever it comes, occurs, you may bet your bottom dollar there'll be no mooning and spooning about it. I mean to marry money. She'll have a good fat account of the banker. She won't do for me. Why, man alive, do you know what it is? I've only to say the word and tomorrow I can have the woman and the cash. You don't believe it? Well, I know it. There are hundreds, what am I saying, thousands of rich Germans and Jews rotten with money. They'd only be too glad. Oh, you wait a while, my boy, see if I don't play my cards properly. When I go about a thing, I mean business, I tell you. You just wait.
He tossed his glass to his mouth, finished his drink and laughed loudly. Then he looked thoughtfully before him and said in a calmer tone,
But I'm in no hurry. They can wait. I don't fancy tying myself up to one woman, you know. Must get a bit stale, I should think.
Little Chandler sat in the room off the hall, holding a child in his arms. To save money, they kept no servant, but Annie's younger sister, Monica, came for an hour or so in the morning and an hour or so in the evening to help. But Monica had gone home long ago. It was 9:15. Little Chandler had come home late for tea, and moreover, he had forgotten to bring Annie home the parcel of coffee from Bewley's. Of course, she was in a bad humour and gave him short answers. She said she would do without any tea, but when it came near the time at which the shop at the corner closed, she decided to go off herself for 1/4 pound of tea and 2 pounds of sugar. She put the sleeping child deftly in his arms and said, Here, don't waken him. A little lamp with a white china shade stood upon the table and its light fell over a photograph which was enclosed in a frame of crumpled horn. It was Annie's photograph. Little Chandler looked at it, pausing at the thin, tight lips. She wore the pale blue summer blouse which she had brought her home as a present one Saturday. It had cost him 10 and 11 pence, but what an agony of nervousness it had cost him. How he had suffered that day waiting at the shop door until the shop was empty, standing at the counter and trying to appear at his ease while the girl piled ladies' blouses for him, paying at the desk and forgetting to take up the odd penny of his change, being called back by the cashier, and finally striving to hide his brushes as he left the shop by examining the parcel to see if it was securely tied. When he brought the blouse home, Annie kissed him and said it was very pretty and stylish. But when she heard the price, she threw the blouse on the table and said it was a regular swindle to charge 10 and 11 pence for it. At first she wanted to take it back, but when she tried it on, she was delighted with it, especially with the make of the sleeves, and kissed him and said he was very good to think of her. He looked coldly into the eyes of the photograph, and he answered coldly. Certainly they were pretty, and the face itself was pretty, but he found something mean in it. Why was it so unconscious and ladylike? The composure of the eyes irritated him. They repelled him and defied him. There was no passion in them, no rapture. He thought of what Gallagher had said about rich Jewesses. Their dark oriental eyes, he thought, how full they are of passion, of voluptuous longing. Why had he married the eyes in the photograph? He caught himself up at the question and glanced nervously round the room. He found something mean in the petty furniture which he had bought for his house on the hire system. Annie had chosen it herself, and it reminded him of her. It too was prim and pretty. A dull resentment against his life awoke within him. Could he not escape from his little house? Was it too late for him to try to live bravely like Gallagher? Could he go to London? There was the furniture still to be paid for. If he could only write a book and get it published, that might open the way for him. A volume of Byron's poem lay before him on the table. He opened it cautiously with his left hand, lest he should waken the child, and began to read the first poem in the book. Hushed are the winds and still the evening gloom. Not even a zephyr wanders through the grove. When I return to view my Margaret's tomb and scatter flowers on the dust I love. He paused. He felt the rhythm of the verse about him in the room. How melancholy it was. Could he too write like that, express the melancholy of his soul in verse? There were so many things he wanted to describe. His sensation of a few hours before on Grattan Bridge, for example. If he could get back again into that mood. The child awoke and began to cry. He turned from the page and tried to hush it, but it would not be hushed. He began to rock it to and fro in his arms, but his wailing cry grew keener. He rocked it faster while his eyes began to read the second stanza. Within this narrow cell reclines our clay, that clay where once it was useless. He couldn't read, he couldn't do anything. The wailing of the child pierced the drum of his ear. It was useless, useless. He was a prisoner for life. His arms trembled with anger, and suddenly bending to the child's face, he shouted, "Stop!" The child stopped for an instant, had a spasm of fright, and began to scream. He jumped up from his chair and walked hastily up and down the room with the child in his arms. It began to sob piteously, losing its breath for 4 or 5 seconds, and then bursting out anew. The thin walls of the room echoed the sound. He tried to soothe it, but it sobbed more convulsively. He looked at the contracted and quivering face of the child and began to be alarmed. He counted 7 sobs without a break between them and caught the child to his breast in fright. If it died. The door was burst open and a young woman ran in panting. "What is it? What is it?" she cried. The child, hearing its mother's voice, broke into a paroxysm of sobbing. "It's nothing, Annie. It's nothing." He began to cry. She flung her purse on the floor and snatched the child from him. "What have you done to him?" she cried, glaring into his face. Little Chandler sustained for one moment the gaze of her eyes, and his heart closed together as he met the hatred in them. He began to stammer. "It's nothing." He began to cry. "I couldn't. I didn't do anything." "What?" Giving no heed to him, she began to walk up and down the room, clasping the child tightly in her arms and murmuring, "My little man, my little Manny, was you frightened, love? There now, love, there now. Lababam, Mama's little lamb of the world, there now." Little Chandler felt his cheeks suffice with shame, and he stood back out of the lamplight. He listened while the paroxysm of the child's sobbing grew less and less, and tears of remorse started to his eyes.
That's all for today's Reading Together programme. But before we go, we want to thank our readers, Joan Morrissey, Deborah Burke, Paddy O'Dwyer, Wendy Conroy, Val O'Donnell, Jerry O'Reilly, Aidan Jordan, and all at Sweeney's Pharmacy for their help and support. Thank you for listening.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.